assuming everybody had a great Thanksgiving, right? It was good. You had lots of turkey, you know. And by the way, for those that were helping, we had a whole bunch of people help by giving away food baskets and stuff on Monday. We not only gave people something to eat in terms of the Thanksgiving, we gave them a dinner on Monday night. A ton of you guys helped out. So good. You guys are amazing in how you helped and blessed a lot of people. And it got me thinking, do you know that 88% of Americans eat at least some turkey during Thanksgiving, right? So almost 9 out of 10 people have turkey. And Americans between Thanksgiving and Christmas consume 6 million turkeys of a cost of approximately $750 million we spend on turkeys. Isn't that crazy? But what I found out is not everybody knows how to cook turkeys, because the Butterball helpline gets 100,000 phone calls a year from people who want help with their turkeys. And it makes sense, because do you know that on Thanksgiving, residential house fires triple every year from people who apparently, I don't know what they're doing. They're causing their houses to burn down. It's just terrible, right? It actually costs $19 million a year in house fires on Thanksgiving. 50 million pies are eaten at Thanksgiving. And this is my favorite. 8.1 billion calories are consumed on Thanksgiving Day. An average of about 4,000 per person. And, bet you didn't know this stat, Black Friday is the busiest day of the year for plumbers. All right? According to Roto-Rooter, they say that's their busiest day of the year. That's crazy, isn't it? And, interestingly enough, 8 of 10 Americans actually prefer eating Thanksgiving leftovers to the actual meal, right? Everybody's like, yeah, oh yeah, absolutely, right? That's why I always say make a whole bunch, because then there's stuff in the fridge later and you can make sandwiches and the stuffing and all that stuff. It's great. It's crazy stuff. And with Black Friday shopping, you know, we've officially kicked ourselves off into this whole season of celebration. And the next 4 weeks, you guys know this is going to be family parties, work parties, celebrations, all kinds of things. It's fantastic. It's enjoyable. But it can also be stressful. Two-thirds of people in America say that their stress level increases in this next 4 weeks. What you can identify, it's a variety of things. For some people, it's just the busyness, right? They get overwhelmed because there's so many things and so many demands on your time, from Christmas programs and kids programs and work parties and personal parties. Plus, you want to have stuff with your friends and your family, and, you know, people are traveling all over the place. Some people, it's just the expectations of family, right? Life goes along great, then you come to this time of year and you have to hang out and see all the people that you haven't seen for a year that you really don't want to see, but you have to see because they're family, you know, and there's all that uncomfortable, you know,ness there. And then there's another one that causes a lot of stress. You know what it is? Money. Because we go through this season and there's so many expectations and we want to buy good things for our kids and we want to buy for our friends, but then we're part of this white elephant and someone says, you got to come for this. And then at work, they're doing exchange of this and that. And there's all the charitable organizations are asking for all this stuff at this time, and on and on and on it goes. Well, we've come to the very end, the last chapter in James. We've got 3 weeks left. It's the end of his letter. Remember, he didn't write it in chapters. He just wrote a letter. So we're getting towards the end of that letter. And if you remember, if you've been here through all of this, what we've said, the main idea of James is simply this, is that authentic faith produces authentic deeds. So the whole idea that James is getting at, has been getting at for all these weeks, is that what you say you believe, right, is not the key issue. It's what you do reflects what you actually believe. And an authentic faith, a faith that really follows Jesus, is actually going to come out in the things that we do and how we live our life. And so last week, we saw how this played out and how we saw the future. But this idea of authentic faith producing authentic deeds is nowhere more apparent than in what James addresses next. And it's how we use and see money. One person, actually, they put it this way. He said this: how I steward my wealth reveals my spiritual health. Interesting. So here's what I want you to do this morning. We're going to talk through this and kind of go through what James was talking about. I want to keep you this question in your mind as we go through it. And it's simply this question: who or what decides where my money and resources get used? Just be asking yourself that. Like, who is it? Are you the sole person who decides? For some of you guys, it's like, no, my wife decides, right? I mean, I don't know. So for some of you, it's like, my kids, that's just where everything, they pick everything, right? Or maybe it's a what? Like, what determines where I use it? Is it the needs of my home? Is it my bills that I feel obligated to? Is it the loans that I accumulated when I was in college? You know, what or who decides where your money, my money and resources get used? And because this is such a fun topic, we're going to pray before we start. Lord, I thank you because your word, what you had written through people so long ago is so applicable. It's applicable in all time and space. It's not just for then, it's for us today. And that your goal in all this is for us to draw closer to you, to know you better, to experience the joy and the fulfillment and the significance and the security that comes from following along behind you and being a disciple. So that's what we want. So would you speak to us this morning? Will you cause this all to land where you want it to land, that your spirit would poke and prod and encourage us like we always ask as we look through this morning? So we pray this all in your name. Amen. All right, well, James starts this whole section with this. Now listen, you rich people. Now there's two things that we have to kind of get out of the way before we start. Number one is this section was actually probably the only part of the letter that was not addressed to Christ followers. Interestingly. Because when he says, now you rich people, and we're going to read through what he says, it's not like everything else. Because everything else, he gives them, hey, you shouldn't be doing this because here's how you should be doing it. You shouldn't be living like this. Here's the solution. He doesn't do that here. In this one, for the first time, his tone changes a little bit, and he actually looks like he is criticizing those that are not Christ followers. He actually, and you can see this because he contrasts what he's doing in this with the section we're going to look at next week because they're tied together. And the next week part seems to be all about followers of Jesus, and this is not. He kind of contrasts them, which is a little odd because I thought, well, why would you, he's writing a letter to people who say they follow Jesus. Why would he, in a letter to Jesus followers, address people who are not Jesus followers? It's actually a rhetorical device. It's called an apostrophe, actually. And what they do is they address people who aren't there for the benefit of the people who are. Okay, we're going to talk about why that works here. But it actually really helps because what he's doing is saying, I'm addressing those people, but the reason I'm doing that is so you all get what's going on here and what you need to do. That's number one. So we do have to pay attention, even though it's maybe addressed to people outside the church. Here's number two. He says, you rich people, and 95% of you said, I'm good. I don't have to listen this morning. This doesn't apply to me. I'm not rich. Well, here's the thing. You think to yourself, I don't hire people, I don't fire people, I'm not in charge of things. And we talked about this before, but I want to remind you. They did a survey years ago, and they talked to people who made $25,000 a year, and they said, what would it take for you to be rich? How much would you have to make? And they said, oh, if I made $50,000, I'd be rich. And then they talked to people who made $50,000. They said, are you rich? They said, no. But what would it take for you to be rich? They said, well, if I made $100,000, I'd be rich. So they talked to people who made $100,000 a year, and they said, are you rich? They're like, no, I'm not rich at all. Well, what would it take for you to be rich? They said, well, if I made $250,000 a year, I'd be rich. And so on. You can see the pattern, right? They went to the 250s. They said, no. Oh, I'm not rich. You have no idea what kind of bills I have. I would need to make 500. And the people that made 500 said, no, I'm not rich. But if you get me up to a million, and it never stops. Because nobody thinks they're rich. And yet every single person in this room probably has multiple sets of clothes. Some of you have multiple rooms for your multiple sets of clothes. You have rooms in your house that no one uses except twice a year when they come to sleep at your place. You buy things to get new things when the old things never even wore out or broke in the first place. You just want something new. Here's the thing, guys. We are rich. And compared to what is going on in most of the world and most of history, we are rich people. This applies to us. And you may not feel it. It may not seem like it as you go through your day-to-day life. But it's true. And if you can't be convinced that you are rich, you all want to be a little richer. And so this applies to everybody. So, let's take a look at what's actually going on here. Because he's going through this whole thing here, right? You rich, now listen, you rich people. And he's condemning them. And in doing this, he does two things, okay? So there's two things in this whole section that James is doing, okay? So what he's doing is he's indicting the rich. He's condemning the rich people. But in the process of condemning these rich people for what they're doing, he's actually issuing a warning for how we use our resources. He's saying, look, you got to be careful. Your money and resources, here's how you need to use them. And then secondly, and this is what we're going to look at next week, he then puts the bullseye on, well, how do we respond when life isn't fair, when things aren't going well? How do we respond positively in the midst of all the messes of life that are connected to this and other things? Money. That's, you got to come back next week for that part, okay? So we're going to look at the first part, which is appropriate at this time of year more than any other time of year, which is money. Now listen. Let me read it again. Now listen, you rich people. Weep and wail because of the misery that is coming on you. Your wealth, it has rotted. Moths have eaten your clothes. Your gold and silver are corroded. Their corrosion will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire. You've hoarded wealth in the last days. Look, the wages you failed to pay the workers who mowed your fields are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. You have lived on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You have fattened yourselves in the day of slaughter, and you have condemned and murdered the innocent one who was not opposing you. Now, let's be clear, right up front. The condemnation in this passage is not against people who have lots of money. Okay? The issue always in James, remember, we've been talking about this now for 2 months. What James is always after is not what? Not what's on the surface, it's the attitude under the surface. It's the thing that causes people to behave a certain way. So what he's not doing, he's dealing with the attitudes towards our money and our stuff, not the stuff itself. That's the whole point. So here's kind of the main idea. And I always try and think of how do I boil all this down to one main idea. And today I'm doing this in the form of a question, because I would say it's this way. Money is a means to an end. So what ends are you using it for? Because that's really where James is going with this. Money is simply a means to an end, and what really matters then is the question, well, what ends am I actually using it for? And so we're going to look at two main truths, and one is how we use money and stuff, and how the other is how we get it. Okay? It's two pieces. Because every one of us gets money a certain way, uses money a certain way. So he's looking at both pieces of this. Okay? So let's take a look at it. I think there's two big things that come out of these verses that should be really helpful for us, actually. And the first is simply this. Stuff is temporary. Y'all know this. Okay? Stuff is temporary. He says, and listen, you rich people, right? You have this, your wealth is rotted. Moths have eaten your clothes. Your gold and silver are corroded. See, in Jesus' day, back when this was written, in James' day, they didn't have climate-controlled houses, you know, or climate-controlled storage units. So when he says the moths ate their clothes actually got worn out. You know, we would have that today, except that we have, you know, these nice places where we keep all our stuff, right? He says, look, your stuff's going to wear out. Your moths, you have all these extra clothes, they're being eaten up, things are wearing out, stuff wore out, things went bad quickly, and yet despite all of our modern advancements, this still happens. Stuff wears out. Y'all know this. The end result of wealth is that it always vanishes. So, what are the implications of that? I think there's a couple in here. Since our stuff is temporary, our enjoyment of stuff is also temporary, right? So we get enjoyment from stuff. You know that, right? Like when you buy something new, it feels good. And you all, if you've ever bought a new car, right? What's the best time of a new car? It's the first week, isn't it? And you're sitting behind the wheel and you're like, it doesn't smell like my dog, right? It's a new car smell. And everything's clean. And everything's wonderful. And the dashboard, you feel like you're in the cockpit of an airplane. And you're like, it links to my phone. It does everything. It does basically can drive my, you know, and you're just so excited. And 4 months later, you know what it is? A car. That gets you to work. That has a McDonald's wrapper or a Chick-fil-A milkshake thing in the back, right? New clothes are great, but after the fifth time you've worn them, they just went in that second closet with all the other outfits that you bought. Stuff is temporary. And if you don't believe me, answer this really quickly. Name me all the gifts you got last year for Christmas. Right? Maybe if you're good, you can think of one or two. If I went and said, what's the most significant you got 3 years ago? I have no idea. I don't even know if I have it anymore. I think I threw that thing out. So just keep that in mind. All the energy and all the money you're going to put into buying gifts this year will be forgotten by this time next year. Interesting. Our stuff is temporary. James says, look, the stuff is temporary. You're getting all this stuff. You have more than you need, but it's temporary. Your enjoyment's temporary. And since it's temporary, it actually can't bring you real security. Because that was James' condemnation of these guys. He says, look, there's nothing wrong with saving the future. There's nothing wrong with for the retirement. But when you obsess about having enough, which is what these people were doing, right? They were accumulating more than they needed. They were hoarding things for their future. They were never giving. They were never throwing anything away. They were worrying whether there was going to be enough of this or enough of that. It's unhealthy. I remember after Hurricane Sandy, I don't know if any of you did this. At the time, our church went down and helped some people, right? Went down to the shore, and there was, you know, all those houses that were wrecked. And I remember going down, because we had to go down, we spent a whole day helping clean out and rip apart part of a house where it had flooded and needed to be replaced. But the house we went into, the lady was a hoarder. I'll never forget it. Because this was a disaster. I mean, it was just junk everywhere. And she was hovering over us all the time. Well, don't throw that out. Just move it over there. You know, so we were basically ripping apart insulation and drywall and stuff around all the edges of our rooms. But all the stuff in the middle, we had to stay. It was, you know, we had to keep that because that was important. In some ways, and there's an entire show was built around things like this, right? We watched some of them, right? Buried Alive, you know. Since stuff is temporary, okay, James is saying, look, all this stuff you're doing, all this security you think you're accumulating, all this stuff you think you're getting out of this, it doesn't last. It won't give you the security that you're hopeful for. Because no matter how much you save, no matter how much money you put aside, no matter how much you worry about all this, you're all going to die. And so am I. And when you die, your kids are going to go through your house, they're going to take three things, and then they're going to call a dumpster. It's true. And all that stuff that was so important and had all these things and all this significance and all these things that helped you for your future will just be gone. James says, like, you guys are missing the point here. You're hoarding all this stuff for the future, but it doesn't bring security. But here's the last thing then. Since stuff is temporary, then it has no eternal value. James uses this interesting statement. He says, their gold and silver are corroded. But anybody who knows anything, gold doesn't corrode, right? That's the whole point of it, right? It doesn't rust. So some people think that when James was writing this, it's because the gold back then wasn't as pure as it was today, and there was other metals in there, and so there would be some level of corrosion. But I think that's kind of reaching a little bit. Most people think what James is doing here is very, very specific, because he's making the point that even the stuff that you're putting your hope in for the future, the thing that is most valuable, the thing you think will not wear out, has no eternal value. All that money that we think we can count on for security and safety will not save us in the end. And if we focus on it alone, it will bring misery. In fact, it's a very weird statement. He says, weep and wail because of the misery that is coming on you. If you saw a rich person, would those be the first two words that came into your mind? You're like, no, I have nothing. That's where the weeping and the wailing is. There's misery here. They got tons of money. There is no weeping and wailing. I mean, they can buy anything they want. They're well off. She's got a good job. He's got a great paying job. Together, they're doing awesome. You should see their house. It's beautiful. When we go over there for discipleship family, it's like, wow, this is amazing. I wish I had that much. They are not weeping and wailing. I'm weeping and wailing. And yet James spins it. They have all the good stuff. And that's because what James has in mind here is an eternal impact, an eternal judgment. Saying, look, you're putting all your focus into this stuff. It's temporary and it's going to wear out. And when you die, it won't help you at all. In fact, what is awaiting you is misery and judgment because you're using this all for yourself and you're ignoring your Lord. In fact, he uses this term, you have hoarded wealth in the last days. It's a very significant little term, because the term last day simply means the time since Jesus came to when he's coming back. Right? So Jesus came, he lived, he died, he rose again, and he went to heaven, and he said, when I go, I'm coming back. And so the last days, when the Bible talks about the last days in the New Testament, they're talking about now, today. And he's saying, look, in this time, you're in the last days when everything's winding down, when Jesus is going to bring all things together, and the kingdom's come to the fullness, and you're worried about your 401k? What is wrong with you? This isn't what matters. The kingdom matters. And if all you focus on is yourself and your stuff, when you die, you'll be miserable. Because the energy of these rich people is in the here and now. But remember what we said, money is a means to an end. So the question is, what end are we using it for? And when the end is to accumulate stuff, to be comfortable, it never actually delivers what we think. Right? So think about this. This is what we spend it on. And James is kind of pointing the finger. If you think that your money and your stuff is primarily about you and your security and all the stuff, he says you're missing. It's temporary. It doesn't do any of that. That's how you use it. But then he switches gears a little bit. And he kind of focuses a little bit on how they get it. And I think of it this way. Possessions can possess us. And James is putting the bullseye right here. And so he goes in this little rant, if you will, this little thing where he goes against these people who were paying... not paying their wages. See, because remember, the problem here isn't that these people had money, it's what they did with it. Okay? So what they were doing was, they were living on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. And they, what was happening is, the stuff that they possessed, the money they had, was beginning to possess them. So here's what I mean by that. Getting more stuff leads to wanting more stuff. Okay? Do you understand this, right? Sometimes we think, you know, if I just had this, then I would be happy. If I made just a little bit more, it would all be good. That is a lie. It will never work. Anytime you get more, you want more. James uses these terms. He says luxury, self-indulgence. How do you like that term? You fattened yourself in the day of slaughter. Kind of appropriate considering what we just ate this week. Do you know what that picture is? I mean, think of the picture. Do you know what they do when they want to give you this prime piece of beef or this really plump turkey? Do you know what they do? They feed them. And they feed them to excess. They feed them more than they need, because what they know is the body of the animal, as it ingests more and more food, right? It's not exercising it away, is they get fatter. There's more meat. There's more juice. It's tender. It's all that. I mean, that's what happens. That's when you have these nice, fat, juicy turkey. That's where it's coming from. And so the picture that James is saying, it says, this is what you're doing. You have all this excess. And what you're doing is you're so consumed with having more stuff, having the things that you like, living this wonderful life where you get all the things that are yours. And you keep wanting more and more and more and more and more and more and more. And every time you get more, you want more, and you get more and you want more. And you all know this, because if you had gone to yourself when you were 15 and said, someday you're going to be making this much money, you would have said, oh, I'm going to be rich. And now you're there and you're thinking, I need more. I don't have enough to pay my bills. Right? More. We want more. The problem with money is that when you use it to satisfy yourself and your appetite does not get satisfied. It gets bigger. There was a story told of this rich kind of industrialist business guy, had tons and tons of money, really busy, but one time he finally got a vacation. He hadn't been away on vacation in years. So he goes down to the shore where he went, and he noticed as he was walking by the one day, there was a fisherman standing there, or sitting there. He had his boat. It was probably, you know, mid-morning. And the boat's there, and the fisherman's sitting there, and he's kicking back. He's got his feet up, smoking a cigar, and the industrialist was like, what are you doing? Why are you not fishing? Fisherman said, well, I already went out fishing. I caught some fish. Why aren't you catching more? What would I do with that? And the industrialist said, well, if you caught more fish, you could sell them. Yeah, what would I do with that? He says, well, if you sold them, you understand you'd have more money. If you do that long enough, you could invest. You could have more boats. You could have a bigger fleet. You could actually have a lot more money. In fact, I could show you how to get really rich. And he goes, well, that's interesting. So then when I do all that and I have all that, then what would I do? He said, then you would finally have a chance to sit and relax and enjoy yourself. You know, just because we have everything we need doesn't mean we don't get more or want more. The next best car, the next best phone. Do you know what the best way is to get rid of an appetite and keep possessions from possessing you? Best way to get rid of an appetite is not to satisfy it. It's to deny it. If you want to get rid of an appetite, you know, that just says, I just feel this compulsiveness. You know, and every time I feel bad, I want to go shopping. Every time I worry about this, you know, I'm worried about my bills. I got to do this and I got to make a little bit more and I got to do this. Do you know how you fix that? Don't do it. Stop spending. Say, I'm not doing that anymore. In fact, the best antidote when you're too consumed with yourself and money is give it away. Practice denial. Because what James is pointing out to these people says, look, your possessions are getting you because you're putting all this focus into it. And in the end, you're so self-focused. You're so self-confident. It's all about you providing for yourself, doing things your way for your things. And instead of being God-confident, we're self-confident. Instead of being reliant on God, we're relying on ourselves. And instead of having self-control, we're self-indulgent. And instead of seeking God, we're seeking self. Self-gratification ends up being a way of life instead of finding it in Jesus. So that's what happens. He says getting more leads us to wanting more, and our possessions begin to own us. But there's a second piece to this, because it's getting more ends up leading us to ignore the good of others. James is condemning these rich people not because they're rich. It's because of what they were doing with it. And so he uses a very specific illustration. He says, look, you are failing to pay the workmen who mowed your fields. Now you have to understand their culture, right? So honestly, the people in James's church that he's writing to are probably the workmen who are mowing the fields for these other people. So these were people, they were landowners, right? People who had lots of land. And so what they would do is when you worked for a landowner, they paid you every day, okay? So you got to the end of the day, they handed you the money for what you worked for that day, and you took it and you went home. It wasn't like today, you know, where you have this biweekly paychecks, none of that stuff. And so what happened was, if you didn't pay your workmen and they went home, they couldn't buy dinner. So when these people came and worked, it wasn't like, everything's taken care of for the next 2 months. This is just for my savings plan. No. They worked and they took the money at the end of the day and they went home and they stopped at the market on the way home and they bought food and they put it on the table. And so when they're not paying these people, he's saying, look, you rich people, you're so consumed with yourself, you're completely missing that you should be paying these people. They withheld their resources from those who worked for them. And here's the implication. If I'm not giving it to them, where does it reside? In my pocket. My stuff. For me. For what I want. And you say to yourself, yeah, well, I'm not paying anybody. I'm not like own a business. I would never not give someone their paycheck. Yet I wonder how many times the stuff stays in my pocket when it should be going somewhere else. Helping other people. And looking for what they need. In their efforts to get more, these people took advantage of others. Actually, and he uses some very strong language here. He says you've condemned and murdered the innocent one. That most people think this is a little bit hyperbole, and they're thinking it's judicially, not necessarily physically, so they're not killing them. But he says what you're doing by not paying them, you're taking advantage of them. You're actually making it so you get to benefit from them, because if they can't pay their bills, you get to take their land. You get to take what they own. You get to own what they own. Your holdings increase, theirs decrease, and you're killing them. Because you're taking away their livelihood. You're taking away their ability to support their families. I wonder how many times we have gotten our stuff. Because what they're doing is they're getting their wealth questionably. And I wonder how many times we've done the same thing. You think, I've never done that. I've never cheated. So let me give you an example. A few years back, we had friends. They had a child. And they asked my wife to be a childcare for this young lady for the first year of her life. And so for, I don't know, 3 days a week, 4 days a week, she would watch her like a nannying kind of thing. Well, this is an all-cash business. Because once a month, they would give my wife money, and put it aside. And over the course of the year, you know, she made a decent little bit of money. And then tax time came. And the temptation is, nobody knows about this. Why on earth would I tell anybody? Except it was income. We were supposed to report it, and we're supposed to pay taxes on it. And we were faced with a choice. What do you do? People take advantage of the system all the time. And you know what God's saying? You're not getting away with it. You think you're getting away with it. You're not. Because look what he says. By the way, it all ended well. We paid the taxes. He says, you've lived on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. But right before that, he says, the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. It's a very interesting term he uses for the Lord Almighty. This is the same term they used when they were talking to God as the head of the battle forces of heaven. The Lord of hosts, the Lord of the angel armies. And what he's saying is, hey, you take advantage of your stuff. You ignore other people. God hears. He sees. In fact, there's this picture of the money itself is crying out because it's sitting in your pocket when it should be helping other people. It says, God hears that. And by the way, also hears the people who are needy because you didn't do what you were supposed to do. He hears all that. That is not forgotten. And by the way, this goes into next week because then there's an encouragement then those for those people on the other side of that. But that's not the point here. We're looking at that next week. The point here is the people who aren't doing it. Possessions always have the potential to get us. Someone once said this, God doesn't want your stuff, but he doesn't want your stuff to get you. Because he knows what kind of damage that causes. Money is a means to an end. What end are you using it for? All right. This is kind of how he wraps up then. This is the main idea behind this whole thing is how we use our wealth matters. How you use your money, how you use your stuff, it matters. It's not just about this life. There's way more to it than that. The truth is the way you get money and the way you use money has eternal implications. Because this entire section is about judgment. Saying here's how you guys lived your whole lives. When you get to the end, you are accountable for your checkbooks. Which is a terrifying thought for a lot of us. And the things that advance the kingdom will have eternal impact and everything else fades away. So for the people, and by the way, there's a present and a future pain. You know how he talks about misery? It's not just in the end. It's not just judgment. When our whole focus is on us and our stuff, there's misery here. Because you're worried all the time, you're overworking, you're doing too many hours, you're getting money under the table, you're taking cash for this, because you're just trying to manipulate all these things to make ends meet, and it doesn't help. And since we're living in the last days, are we simply trying to amass stuff and be comfortable and happy, live a wonderful life? Or are we things that give us treasure later? Remember, they're not being condemned for their wealth. They're being condemned for hoarding their wealth for themselves. And in some ways, what James is saying is, hey, if you're rich and that's the way you're living your life, then you already have had heaven. It's just been here. It's been heaven on earth. And when your life's over, there's nothing left for you. There's a story, there's a guy, you can look this guy up, a guy named John G. Wendell. And he and his sisters, they were some of the most miserly people around. They had gotten this huge inheritance from their parents. They spent very little of it. They were actually more wealthy landowners in New York than the Rockefellers. They owned a ton of Manhattan. This is early in the 1900s and up into the 1930s. But they were so consumed with keeping their stuff and hoarding it that the brother convinced four of his five sisters to never marry. Because if you married, you lost control of some of the wealth. And so what happened was they lived in this little tiny apartment building in the middle of Manhattan. They expanded their empire when they died in today's value worth over $1 billion. And when the last sister died in 1931, her only dress was one that she had made herself 25 years earlier. And they had such a compulsion to hoard and to grab and to hold all this money together that they lived like paupers. Did nothing with it. It was interesting. When they died, they estimated about 2,500 people came forward saying they were related to them, tried to get their $1 billion. It's an interesting story. Now, you might not have that kind of treasure, but the question we asked at the very beginning remains, right? The one we asked way back in the beginning, which is simply this. What or who decides where I use my money? and resources. Money is simply a means to an end. And so as you go through this season, what are the ends that you're using it for? Is your primary purpose the comfort of yourself, your house, your stuff, your car? Remember, your stuff's temporary and your enjoyment of them is temporary. And the only way you replace that is to get something new so you can enjoy that. It's all going to wear out. It's not going to give you security. It's not going to have any eternal value. So how do you make sure that your possessions don't get possession of you? I saw this quote, I thought it was really good, by Randy Alcorn. It said, God prospers me not to raise my standard of living, but to raise my standard of giving. That's kind of cute. I like that. Because how we use our wealth matters. And what's cool about all this, okay? This all seems so heavy. This is actually really cool. Do you realize that with your checkbook and your what's in your pocket, you have the ability to influence things that will last for the next billion years? You have the ability to actually, we together have the ability to make such a difference that it will echo into eternity for all time. There's almost nothing else we can do that does it. It's amazing. It's a tremendous opportunity. And then someday when we stand before the Lord who gave up everything for us, we can say, well, I gave up my stuff for you. It was the least I could do. So, if money is a means to an end, and the question is, what ends are we using it for? I would say this. If money talks, what does it say about you? So I'm going to give you a challenge this Christmas season. I'm giving the same challenge to myself, which is this, simply this. Take some of the money this Christmas that you would have spent on yourself and use it for somebody else. And I'm not giving you the out that if you already plan to do this and you've already done this, okay, I always do that. I always give a little bit of money here. Okay, do all that stuff. Okay, then on top of that, okay, not, well, I did this already at Thanksgiving. I helped someone out and I bought them this. No, 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 that doesn't count. What I'm saying is from here on out, in addition to anything you're going to do, as you go through your weeks, as you go through these days, and as you're doing your shopping, say, you know what? I'm actually not going to do this. I'm not going to spend this on myself. I'm not going to spend it on my kids. In fact, I'm going to say, God, who is in need? Where do you want this to go? And then go do it. Do you know if you do this with your kids, they'll remember this Christmas more than they remember any other Christmas? And you say to your kids, hey, we're actually going to take this and we're going to go help somebody. We're going to buy an entire basket of food and toys. And we're going to find someone who needs it. We're going to give it to them. And I'm telling you, if you say, well, I don't know anybody like that, pray. God will show you. And then take them along. Best teaching moment you could possibly imagine. Money is a means to an end. That's it. So what ends are you using it for?